Western country out of the equation. These militant organizations, these Deobandi influenced militant organizations, they are in itself a very problematic and a big security threat for Pakistan. So Imran Khan's insistence that, you know, we should talk with them, and we should rehabilitate them within the Pakistani population, that has been seen as a weakness by TTP. Look, a state can only negotiate with a militant organization with an upper hand. The problem was the Pakistanis does not have an upper hand as of now, and they want to negotiate. When you negotiate with a poorer position, it means that the militant organization will take it as you bowing down to their whim. And this is never good for the security of any country.
Since its inception in 2007, the Tehrik-e-Taliban has been in a state of rebellion with the successive governments of Pakistan. Hit by a recent wave of terrorism, there has been a resurgence in the terrorist attacks, especially in the provinces of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan. In the year 2022 alone, more than 150 attacks were carried out by the outfit, mainly against the defense forces, resulting in more than 150 deaths. The present economic and political turmoil has been regarded as one of the reasons of this resurgence.
Since withdrawing from the ceasefire signed between the government of Pakistan and the TTP, the Tehrik-Taliban Pakistan has been responsible for more than 100 attacks in the last 1 year. The outfit has intensified its attack on the Pakistani army and police since November 2022. There's a looming threat of rise in the violence in the coming months, and according to the security experts, 2023 may prove to be a bloody year. The defense analysts link this terrorism surge to the worst economic crisis and political instability that Pakistan is facing. Issuing warning to the Pakistani armed forces carrying out operations against its fighters in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, the Pakistani Taliban has threatened of targeting the security forces throughout the country.
Such big incidents always galvanize every strata of the society. So the people, government, intelligence agencies, army, they all normally come on the same page when such a huge attack takes place. So, but the problem is this coming together on one page that does not survive for a very, very long time, as we saw in the case of APS attack. When the APS attack happened, immediately after that, an operation was launched and the entire area was cleared of Tehrik-e-Taliban. I mean, it was a very, very bloody fight, but the success was achieved. Now, the problem is the last Pakistani COS, his legacy is, sorry to say, very, very poor in all regards, in the way he has interfered in the politics of Pakistan, the way he has squandered whatever achievements which his predecessors have done vis-a-vis TTP in the tribal belts. So now what is happening is that once again, every a part of the country, which means every stakeholder, army, intelligence agencies, people, government, they appear to be on the same page as of now. And this would always mean that there would be an operation to eradicate them.
Pakistan has been battling with terrorist attacks since the past 2 decades. However, the intensity has increased in the last 3 months, with the Tehrik-Taliban Pakistan breaking the Afghan-Taliban-arranged ceasefire accord between the Pakistani government and the Taliban fighters. In one of the deadliest attacks since 2018, on 4th March 2020, the Islamic State Khorasan province attacked in Peshawar in March last year, resulting in the death of 64 people. The latest violence has raised the horror alarm amongst the residents of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, fearing a military operation in the tribal areas.
Militant agencies all over the world, they do give threats. The only difference is in the case of TTP, we must take it very seriously. Because every time they have given a threat, they have managed to sort of create some incident or the other, which is very, very spectacular. Because that is what they want. They want a spectacular incident to happen so that it will sort of boost their image among the population, which is attracted toward this special Deobandi influenced jihad. So what is happening is that to achieve that, they go out of the way. Now, what is problematic is that because of the deeply entrenched Deobandi ideology inside the general population of Pakistan, it is very easy for TTP to find sympathizers from not only within the governments, but also within the security agencies and intelligence agencies and army and everybody, because the people of Deobandi ideology make a large portion of population in Pakistan. So the problem is the ease with which they infiltrate the government machinery. This is very, very problematic. So their threat should never be taken as an idle threat. Their threat, most of the time, is followed by a bite. So I guess that this threat would be taken seriously in Islamabad, and I think the security agencies, army, and the civilian government will be on the same page to deal very, very strongly with this organization.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Leaving a controversial legacy behind, Pakistan's former president Parvez Musharraf died at the age of 79. The four-star general who seized power after the 1999 military coup was known as a key US ally against the Al-Qaeda in South Asia. The response to his death in Pakistan was muted, with many senior figures refraining from commenting on his complex legacy out of respect. Shahbaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, whose brother Nawaz Sharif was overthrown and imprisoned by Musharraf, tweeted offering condolences to the family of the former general.
Musharraf was born in a lower middle class family in Delhi that moved to Karachi after the partition of 1947. Securing a place in Pakistani army, he quickly rose through the ranks and became Pakistan's top military general, leading a bloodless coup against the Nawaz Sharif's government in 1999. After the 9/11 attacks, Musharraf became known for his close alliance with the U.S. and its war on terror. He was once described by the former U.S. President George W. Bush as a courageous leader and a friend of the United States. His decision to align with the U.S. contradicted Pakistan's long-standing support for the Taliban, who controlled Afghanistan during that period. Proving to be damaging for Pakistan, the decision made Musharraf a target for domestic militant groups. His support to the U.S. invasion proved deeply unpopular, as it led to heavy civilian casualties, resulting in a deep anti-Western sentiment throughout the country. However, it seems that Pakistan had no other choice. In the words of Musharraf, the Bush administration had threatened to bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age had the country not cooperated with America's war on Afghanistan.
For some, the ex-military ruler of Pakistan was an able administrator, a person with a modern outlook who was credited with attracting foreign investment. He garnered the support of the military and Pakistanis who backed his crackdown against the militant groups. While many condoled the demise of the main architect of Kargil War, others questioned his legacy, believing that he failed to build on his early popularity of promoting sustainable economic and political reforms. He turned into a captive of military power and vested interests.
In February 1999, just weeks after the then Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee visited Lahore on the invitation of Sharif to try to make a breakthrough in bilateral relations by signing the Lahore Declaration, Pakistani troops disguised as irregular fighters secretly infiltrated the line of control in the Kargil sector. It triggered a brief but fierce border conflict that ended disastrously for the Pakistani side. While Musharraf claimed that the ceasefire in Kargil was a military triumph, others in Pakistan considered it one of the biggest tragic blunders in Pakistan's history. Kargil war was responsible for the first confrontation of two atomic powers, resulting in the increase in tensions between India and Pakistan. Another consequence of Kargil war was the refusal of the U.S. to reward Pakistan for its aggression. America insisted on Pakistan's withdrawal to the line of control. This led to an immediate and positive impact on the Indo-U.S. relations and changed the geopolitics of the region. Pakistan was heavily criticized by many countries for instigating the war. Even China, a longtime friend of Pakistan, insisted on a pullout of forces along the LOC. On the other hand, India was praised internationally for its restraint, resulting in further weakening the position of Pakistan.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Munir Ahmad from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Mr. Ahmad, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Parvez Musharraf was a general who took power with a coup and was forced into exile later. So the question is, what lesson has his life given to the people and the governments in the region?
Certainly, yes. There are many lessons to learn from General Musharraf's era and from him as well. He was the dictator, as everyone knows, and he toppled the democratic government. First of all, majority of the country did not accept him as a ruler, because everyone in Pakistan, the general public, has been like frustrated about the dictatorship and the military corporates that are run in Pakistan. And the second lessons that is to be learned from that was the sort of democratic process he launched. Mostly, they were all the third-rate, mostly the third-rate politicians he collected around him, and those who call like always go for vested interest. And they were not the politicians, but the rejected people of in the politics of Pakistan. And then, and what the regime they developed in Pakistan, the I'm talking about the political regime, and that was not acceptable to most of the people. And thirdly, allegations of corruption against the politicians and arrests on some so-called corruption cases was also not liked by the people, and it was merely called political victimization.
Mr. Ahmad, so for many Pakistanis, Musharraf left behind a grim legacy. Is his legacy still having an impact on the country?
His legacy is no more, I believe. But the elements he promoted in Pakistan still exist. Even when the establishment has to oust the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif from the government, he launched Imran Khan, who was already a power monger and power hungry at that time. And he could not have been getting much popularity in the political arena. So establishment took him as their main horse, and they collected all those rejected pieces again around him. And those promoted one are still in the politics of Pakistan and in the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. And they are around with Imran Khan. So I think they still exist in the politics, but as far as we say, like the legacy of Parvez Musharraf in terms of its own political party, that does not exist. But the elements of his party has joined mostly PTI or have been silent for some time.
Mr. Ahmad, the Kargil war can be considered as one of the most important events during Musharraf's tenure. What lasting effect did the war have on Pakistan?
Kargil war, I must not say that it as a war, But that misadventure of General Musharraf has so many implications for Pakistan's diplomacy and friendly the efforts to have friendly ties with India. And also, like, it has created chaos among the ranks of the establishment, army, and the politicians, that the misadventure that led to more bitter relationship with India, and also Pakistan sacrificed so many lives of the soldiers over there, and still we feel that we cannot cope up with the damage that Kargil war did to Pakistan, to its society, and its to bilateral relations with India. And we still feel that Pakistan and India shall have friendly bilateral ties, so that because half of the families live in India and half of the families live in Pakistan, and they have been living for decades or so. And if there are a certain bitterness between the two countries, the visa regimes are stopped, so no visas for the families to go and come to Pakistan. So, and this is really a tyranny for the families and their relationships.
Before we let you go, sir, some experts believe that instead of supporting the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, Musharraf could have negotiated and drawn a red line to maximize Pakistan's strategic interests. What is your opinion on this?
Pakistan's decision to go to go with America for the war with Afghanistan, or in Afghanistan, or attacking Afghanistan, was certainly could have been negotiated, and for more strategic benefits. Whatever we earn of the friendship or the strategic mileage before in the previous two decades before going to war on terrorism was lost during the war on terrorism. And we also lost more than 80,000 of soldiers and civilians in Pakistan, in the Fatah areas and on the borders adjacent to Afghanistan. So that was the major loss. We also had a very collateral damage of billions of rupees in those areas where the Pakistan army was fighting against the terrorists. And the third loss was Pakistan had very bitter and a bitter relationship with Taliban. Though Taliban was not created by Pakistan, but that was the offshoot of the Mujahideen, or the previous war or like jihad against the Russian invasion, quote unquote, in Afghanistan. But if there had been a democratic government or the civilian government, certainly this matter would have been discussed in the parliament. And I believe the Musharraf's coup was to go for such kind of initiative.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Munir Ahmad from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Adil Ali said in his Twitter, "Revenge of injustice with those who make history is always taken by the time itself. Parviz Musharraf tend to be a godfather at his time of power. His leftovers banned the court which punished former dictator, but today all of them are helpless and he's facing revenge of time." Zaytung said, "Parviz Musharraf started a war inside Pakistan on behalf of then ally USA, and now even after his death, our armed forces are facing casualties in war that wasn't ours and wasn't needed to be fought. None of the terrorists fighting Pakistan today were anti-Pakistan before that." Adil Rajah said in his tweet, "Death of a dictator forced out of power by his own. Stark reminder for those seeking artificial political legitimacy for their puppet rulers." Muazzam Beg described Musharraf in this way, "The man who had me abducted from Pakistan in front of my kids in 2002 and boasted about CIA bounty cash he earned selling hundreds of Muslims to be held without charge and tortured in Guantanamo and secret prisons is dead."
And that was our episode about the legacy of Pervez Musharraf, the former president of Pakistan who died at the age of 79 after years in exile. And also the recent suicide bombing in Peshawar, which killed more than 100 people. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The enthusiasm of the Iranian people to protect the achievements of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic as the model system of government for all aspiring societies is another smashing blow on the face of global arrogance and its mercenaries. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote in this regard on Saturday, February 11th, "Multimillion-strong rallies once again brightened up the face of Iran as the masses in some 1,400 towns and cities and 38,000 villages and hamlets marked 44th anniversary of the triumph of the grassroots Islamic movement that threw into the dustbin of history the ruthless Pahlavi potentate and the puppeteers in London and Washington who controlled him. People of all ages, ranging from infants in prams to the elders, jubilantly celebrated the independence of Iran and the life breathed into the nation by Imam Khomeini, the restoration of honor and dignity to Iranian women, and the liberties achieved by all sections of the society. In Tehran, the masses converged on Azadi Square from different directions of the capital to listen to the speech of Iranian President Dr. Sayed Ibrahim Raisi amidst vociferous chants of God's Majesty, Allahu Akbar, and renewal of allegiance to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was a spectacular sight to see the unity of the Iranian people, who unanimously denounced the great Satan, the U.S., and its devilish imp, the Zionist regime, while making a bonfire of the flags of these two arch enemies of humanity." The yardstick of progress of a nation are its achievements in both the spiritual and material fields, including science and technology, and promotion of religious cultural values, such as ethics, public morals, and the dignity of hijab for women. Over the past 44 years, despite the intensity of the plots of its enemies, the Islamic Republic has achieved self-sufficiency in almost all fields. True to the principles of the revolution, it has never hesitated to help nations and people in distress, whether those affected by natural disasters, including earthquakes, floods, famines, and epidemics, or terrorized by the clients of big powers through wars, bloodshed, and sanctions. This is the reason people in various parts of the world, such as the West, Southern and Central Asia, as well as Africa and parts of the Americas, have joined the Iranian people in celebrating the anniversary of the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. For instance, the way the Muslim people of Nigeria held road rallies in Abuja and Kano, and the people of Iraq and Lebanon held gatherings to pay homage to the ideals of the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, was a treat to watch. Meanwhile, Crescent International Road, given the brutal sanctions to which Islamic Iran has been subjected for decades, visitors to the country are surprised to find the massive construction cranes that dot Tehran's skyline, new highways snake through the capital city to keep up with demand of ever-increasing numbers of cars. The same situation is noticeable in other cities. This is one aspect of the rate of progress in Iran. The other more impressive is the growth in knowledge-based companies and the startups in Iran. UNESCO's Science Report 2021 states there has been exponential growth in knowledge-based firms and startups in Iran. This trend is the result of heightened domestic demand combined with the multiplication of technology incubators and accelerators since the launch of the country's first public innovation centers in 2015. UNESCO's report further states by 2020, 49 innovation accelerators had been established with private equity and 113 innovation centers had been set up in partnership with science parks and major universities. Technology incubators, meanwhile, have been providing graduate entrepreneurs with co-working spaces and mentoring on campus to help them launch their own startup. The government has been encouraging startups to diversify into knowledge-based fields. A series of laws and policies adopted since 2015 have removed barriers to competition and enhanced the financial support system for innovation. Between 2014 and 2017, exports of knowledge-based goods grew by a factor of 5, that is 500%, according to UNESCO's report. When Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal in May 2018, and reimposed illegal sanctions, Iran's economy came under great pressure. In 2021, Iran raised its science and technology exports to $1 billion in 70 countries. In some global markets, Iranian companies have overtaken European and American companies. Siavash Maliki, deputy head of the Innovation and Prosperity Fund, was quoted by the Tehran Times as saying, "The number of knowledge-based Iranian companies now exceeds 6,800. With half active in the field of electronics and electricity. It needs recalling that the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, designates each Iranian year, starting in March, for some special objective. The year March 2022 to March 2023 has been designated as the year of production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. Not surprisingly, Iranian scientists and engineers have focused on this area with spectacular results. Iran is also a leader in nanotechnology and aerospace in the West Asia region. Hitherto, its exports went mainly to Iraq, Afghanistan, Russia, and Syria. The new destinations for Iran's science and technology exports will include the Persian Gulf, littoral states, Europe, China, and Central Asia. Given its huge resource base, Iran has the world's fourth largest number of engineering graduates, with some 5 million engineers. It provides a solid base to build a knowledge-based economy. In matters of defense, Iran has become virtually self-sufficient. It has also made impressive gains in missile and drone technology. Not surprisingly, both are being targeted by the collective West and their illegitimate offspring, Zionist Israel. Even Tehran's staunch enemies now admit that Iran has made impressive gains in missile and drone technology. Addressing the International Congress for Women of Influence in Tehran on January 19, 2023, President Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi pointed out that women had made great progress since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February 1979. He elaborated on the significant measures Iran has taken to improve the situation of women. Pointing to the empowerment of women, President Raisi said they had improved their status in scientific, cultural, social, and economic arenas, while observing their human dignity. Women constitute more than 30% of university lecturers in Iran, and close to 60% of university students in the country are women. The path to progress is not found in degradation, but through dignified existence that allows women to lead a life without being molested by men. This is an important lesson that the collective West refuses to learn.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Back in September 2022, a number of blasts occurred in the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipelines. Following the attacks, there were gas leaks around the pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea. Both pipelines are majority owned by the Russian majority state-owned gas company Gazprom. Back then, there was much speculation about who may have been behind the sabotage act, but now a leading U.S. journalist has blamed the blast on the Washington regime. In a detailed report published in his blog, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has claimed that the bombing of the Nord Stream underwater gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea was ordered by the White House and carried out by the CIA with the help of the U.S. Navy. Hersh says the finding is based on his own investigation into the September sabotage. He says U.S. Navy deep-sea divers planted the high-powered C-4 explosives under the gas pipelines under the guise of NATO naval exercises. The bombs were detonated on September 26 with a remote signal sent by a sonar buoy, which was dropped near the Nord Stream pipelines by a Norwegian Navy P-8 surveillance plane. The planning process began back in December 2021, when a special task force was created with the direct participation of U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The White House dismissed the report, but Russian officials say the published facts should become the basis for an international investigation. Russian Foreign Ministry says the United States has questions to answer over its alleged role in explosions. Earlier this month, Germany's public prosecutor general Peter Frank said that Berlin has no evidence linking Russia to the sabotage of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines. According to Hirsch, the Biden administration was focused on Nord Stream pipelines because as long as European countries like Germany remained dependent on those pipelines for cheap natural gas, they would be reluctant to give military aid to Ukraine for a war with Russia, which was looming back then. The U.S. was a major opponent of the Nord Stream pipelines. In 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Nord Stream 2 turned Europe into a hostage of Russia and placed sanctions on any company assisting Russia to complete the pipeline. In December 2020, then-President-elect Joe Biden expressed his opposition to the opening of the new pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Swedish and Danish investigators have already found that the ruptures were a result of sabotage, but they have not specified who was responsible. The attacks occurred in exclusive economic zones of the two European countries. The 1,200-kilometer pipelines, operated by Russian gas giant Gazprom, are not currently in operation. Since the blast occurred, Moscow has blamed the West for the damage to the infrastructure. According to reports, the decision to undermine the Nord Stream 1 and 2 was agreed upon and approved personally by the U.S. President Joe Biden, and that he discussed the issue with his inner circle for more than 9 months.
Senator Cruz, like you, I am, and I think the administration is very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea.
The Russian government described the sabotage as a terrorist attack and said that the U.S. was the nation that benefited most from it by speeding up Europe's attempts to wean itself off Russian gas.
A devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck southeastern Turkey and northwestern Syria early on Monday. The deadly quake and a string of aftershocks have killed thousands of people in both countries and injured more. Hundreds of buildings in both Syria and Turkey have been reduced to rubble. Rescue workers are still working in freezing temperatures to find those still trapped under debris. While Turkey has been aided by its allies and Western partners to cope with the crisis, aid is trickling to sanctions-hit Syria. Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has highlighted Syria's need for humanitarian assistance, warning that the U.S. sanctions have worsened the circumstances as the illegal bans have prevented the delivery of everything to the country. The catastrophe of the earthquake that struck Syria is great, and what has increased its depth is the difficult circumstances that the country has been going through for the past 12 years as it's fighting terrorism and its supporters. What exacerbated the tragedy and catastrophe was the sanctions imposed by the United States and Western countries on Syria. The Syrian top diplomat further said that Damascus had appealed to the member states of the United Nations, the General Secretariat of the organization, its relevant agencies and funds, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and other humanitarian action partners from international, governmental, and non-governmental organizations to extend a helping hand and support Syria's efforts to confront the crisis.
You know, given that the war situation and economic, financial, illegal, inhumane Western sanctions imposed on Syria, at the same time when the U.S. Is imposing, and with its Western allies, imposing almost a blockade around Syria.
As Syria is reeling from the aftermath of the deadly earthquakes, the United States is working with partners to provide earthquake relief in Syria, but will stand firm against working with Syria's legitimate government headed by President Bashar al-Assad. The United States has refused normalization of relations with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad or any direct reconstruction aid.
Lots of the airplane, cargo airplane, refused to land on Syrian airports because of the American and European sanctions. So even those countries who want to send humanitarian assistance, they cannot use the airplane cargo because of the sanctions.
Washington listed Syria as a state sponsor of terrorism in 1979, but since the beginning of the imposed war on Syria in 2011, the United States and its Western allies have imposed a number of economic sanctions and restrictions on Syria. U.S. sanctions intensified with the passing of the CISA Act in 2019, which was signed by former President Donald Trump. The sanctions have severely affected the Syrian economy, especially its construction, finance and energy sectors, and complicated the reconstruction effort.
The hurdles we have, if I talk about the area under government control, we don't have an access problem in terms of authorizations, but we have an access problem in terms of the capacity of the infrastructure to authorize to enable us to do it. I mean, this means we might have to repair a few roads here and there. And we're not the only one. The government is also working on that. But we are in a situation where it was already difficult to do that before. And now we are in a situation where we don't have any other option than doing it.
Syria has been in the throes of foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. While the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group was crushed by the Syrian government, militant outfits continue to hold sway in some parts of the country under the patronage of Western powers. The United States has also established several military bases in northern Syria in a bid to help the terrorists there. Meanwhile, Iran has sent several batches of humanitarian aid to Syria to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The latest batch of aid included food, blankets and carpets. Iran will send more humanitarian supplies to Syria in the coming days. Iran has urged the international community to put pressure on the U.S. to lift its cruel sanctions on Syria to facilitate aid deliveries. The Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement has also sent convoys of humanitarian aid to earthquake-affected areas in Syria.
One of Joe Biden's promises during his presidential campaign was to immediately move to end all support for the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. In February 2021, Biden stood at a podium at the State Department and proclaimed that the war in Yemen must end. Biden underlined the humanitarian crisis as the key reason the United States withdrew support.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
An investigation by the Government Accountability Office found that the United States is training the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S. has troops on the ground in Yemen. Biden confirmed that the United States has troops in Yemen in a letter to Congress in June last year. Simply put, he lied to the world when he claimed that the United States was withdrawing U.S. troops for the war in Yemen in 2021. On the contrary, the United States is making billions of dollars from the war in Yemen, as 200,000 have been killed from direct violence. According to data acquired from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, between 2015 and 2021, the United States sent $54.2 billion in weapons and services to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In addition, the Department of Defense provided $644 million for military training to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, almost entirely through the Foreign Military Sales Program. The DoD uses acquisition and cross-servicing agreements to bill nations for logistical support and items ranging from flying hours, fuel, and bombs. Saudi Arabia paid the United States $157 million in flying hours, and the UAE paid $104 million for flying hours since the Saudi-led intervention began in Yemen in 2015. The United States billed Saudi Arabia and the UAE for $319 million in acquisition and cross-servicing agreements for logistical support. Also, the United States sent $18.6 billion in missiles, $6.2 billion in aircraft, $3.3 billion in ships, and $2.8 billion in military training to attack one of the poorest nations in the world. The United States is well aware that the coalition is not fighting an advanced military in Yemen. Billions of dollars have been spent destroying the country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. The UN Security Council approved a resolution to blockade Yemen since 2015 to prevent arms from flooding the conflict. However, the embargo has only succeeded in starving the Yemenis into famine. On a February 9th phone call in 2022 with the King of Saudi Arabia, Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Biden assured him that the United States would continue to support the war in Yemen. The phone call came 1 year after Biden lied to the world and announced that the U.S. was withdrawing its support of the war in Yemen. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency's Defense Institute of International Legal Studies conducted training at the Saudi War College that focused on the law of armed conflict, including laws related to air-to-ground targeting in May 2017, April 2018, June 2019, and May 2020. The DoD claims they are not responsible for civilian deaths because they provided the Saudis with training to avoid civilian casualties. According to the Yemen Data Project, over 23,000 Saudi-led coalition airstrikes since March 2015 have led to thousands of civilian casualties. A Yemeni human rights organization has warned that the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as well as the crippling siege in the impoverished Arab country, could result in the death of thousands of children suffering from cancer. Intisaf, Organization for Women's and Children's Rights, said in a statement on the occasion of World Cancer Day that more than 3,000 Yemeni children who have developed cancer as a result of Saudi aggression and the tight sea, land, and air blockade on the country are now at significant risk of death. The rights group criticized the international organizations and other relevant bodies for neglecting Yemeni cancer patients over the past years. Intisaf added that the incidence of leukemia is increasing among Yemeni children, saying the cases of kids suffering from blood cancer have soared from 300 to 700 in the capital Sana'a due to the use of internationally banned weapons supplied by the United States and the United Kingdom and used by Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Approximately 1,000 children are also believed to have contracted leukemia in other Yemeni regions due to the same reasons. The rights organization pointed to the dire shortage of medicine needed for the treatment of patients diagnosed with cancer because of the Saudi-led military onslaught and siege, stating that many children lose their lives as a result. The human rights organization noted that the economic hardships caused by the ongoing military aggression and blockade have prevented minor cancer patients from seeking treatment abroad, calling for the opening of Sana'a International Airport for humanitarian purposes. It finally held Saudi Arabia and its allies fully responsible for all crimes and violations being perpetrated against the Yemeni nation, especially children, urging the international community to bear the legal and humanitarian responsibility for the violations against the civilians. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states, launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. The Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, leaving hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and spawning the world's worst humanitarian crisis. We'll be right back.
The Iranian foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdollahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During the meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdollahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla. Both diplomats wrapped the U.S. sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdollahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened vigilance in the face of U.S.-led pressure and bullying. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdollahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned unlawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic has managed to move forward despite the coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdollahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year. Amir Abdollahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian official's visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the U.S. dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against U.S. unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm now in Yazd province. Which city in this province? Mehriz city. I'm going to visit a beautiful historical caravanserai in Mehriz. Zeynuddin Caravanserai. I'm going to stay here at night and watch the stars in the sky of the desert. There is a 400-year history behind this caravanserai. Well, here I arrive. The tranquility and the silence of the desert where the caravanserai is located, the delight of watching the sunrise and sunset from the top of the building where nothing disturbs the view, and the historical value of the caravanserai are the reasons why staying at Zeynuddin Caravanserai is a highly recommended experience in Iran. So, let's head to this historical caravanserai.